What's that for? They were empty.
Jones glanced at the other two. Freeman was shuffling more times than necessary, but Beau met Jones's eyes.
No need to hurry me up,
Gramps said.
I'm getting there fine on my own.
His voice was low, almost a growl. Beau shook his head. Something was a shame, but I didn't know what. Jones cleared his throat. He swallowed.
It's just a drink, Delaney,
he finally said. Gramps looked up at Jones, his eyes fierce, for the entire time that Freeman dealt the cards. The other guys picked up their hands, putting what they received in order. But Gramps just stared, daring Jones to look back. I didn't know what was happening, but I wanted it to end. Gramps, I said. He jerked toward me as though he'd forgotten I was there. I was wondering, I said, not knowing where my sentence would end. Maybe... Will you drive me to school tomorrow? I might feel like sleeping in.
Sure, sailor, he said.
He turned back to the table. He picked up his cards. Everyone was quiet. No heckling. Not a single joke.
I'll bet five,
Gramps said. Jones folded. I went back into my room with the tea and tried to forget. Mabel and I texted for hours. We didn't make plans to sneak out and meet. We didn't even talk. Hearing the other's voice would have been bright and dangerous, so instead we tapped out messages. What were we thinking? I don't know. Did you like it? Yes. Me too. We texted about a song we liked and some random YouTube videos. About a poem we read in English that day, and what we would do if we were faced with the end of the world. We texted about Mabel's uncle and his husband who lived on 3 acres in New Mexico, and how we would make our way there, build a teepee, and dig a well and grow our food, and make the most of what time we had left. The end of the world never sounded so good. I know. I kind of want it to happen. Is that bad? We could do all that stuff even without the apocalypse. Good point. So it's a plan? Yes. It was almost 2 a.m. by the time we said goodnight. I smiled into my pillow, closed my eyes, wished for the feeling to last. I saw our futures unfolding, all pink clouds and cacti and bright sun, and forever. And then I got up and went to the kitchen for water. I filled the glass and gulped it down, then headed toward the bathroom. The door to Gramps' room was ajar. Light was shining through the narrow space. I walked softly past it, and then I heard something rustle and turned back. Gramps was at his desk, his brass lamp burning, his pen moving furiously across his paper. I was quiet. But I could tell. I could have called his name and he wouldn't have looked up. I could have banged the pots and pans together. He was writing his love letters, I told myself. But it didn't look like love. He finished a page and cast it aside, started a next one. He was hunched forward and furious. I turned toward the bathroom and locked the door behind me. He was only writing love letters, I thought. Only love letters. Love letters. Chapter 13. In the stillness of this unfamiliar living room, another memory surfaces. A couple nights after graduation, we all met on Ocean Beach. Everyone was acting wild. Like it was the end of everything. Like we'd never see one another again. And maybe, in some cases, that was true. I found Mabel and joined her on a blanket just in time to hear the punchline of a joke I already knew. I smiled while everybody laughed, and she looked so beautiful in the bonfire glow. We all looked so beautiful. I could say the night felt magical, but that would be embellishment. That would be romanticization. What it actually felt like was life. We weren't thinking of what would happen next. No one talked about the way the summer was supposed to unfold, or the places we'd find ourselves in the fall. It was as if we had made a pact to be in the moment, or like being in the moment was the only way to be. Telling jokes, telling secrets. Ben had his guitar, and for a while he played, and we just listened as the fire sparked and the waves crashed and subsided. I felt something on my hand. Mabel's finger, tracing my knuckles. She slipped her thumb under my palm. I could have kissed her, but I didn't. Now, her hand on mine after so long apart, here in Tommy's house and nowhere close to sleep, I wonder what might have changed if I had. If one of us had made the fact of us common knowledge, we would have become something to be discussed and decided upon. Maybe there would have been no Jacob. Maybe her photograph would be on my bulletin board. Maybe we wouldn't be here now, and I would be in California, in her parents' orange-walled living room, sipping hot chocolate by the Christmas tree. But probably not. Because even though it was only a couple months later that Gramps left me, when I tried to call back that night, it no longer felt like life. When I think of all of us then, I see how we were in danger, not because of the drinking or the sex or the hour of the night, but because we were so innocent and we didn't even know it. There's no way of getting it back. The confidence, the easy laughter, the sensation of having left home only for a little while, of having a home to return to. We were innocent enough to think that our lives were what we thought they were, that if we pieced all of the facts about ourselves together, they'd form an image that made sense, that looked like us when we looked in the mirror. That looked like our living rooms and our kitchens and the people who raised us, instead of revealing all the things we didn't know. Mabel lets go of my hand and kicks back the covers. She sits up, so I do the same. "I guess I'm not ready to fall asleep yet," she says. It's so warm now that I'm glad to have the covers off. We sit on the bed and lean against the cushioned back of the sofa. We're watching the firelight flicker across the room, and Mabel is pulling her hair back, twisting it in circles and then letting it go. And I feel like the night might last forever, and I would be okay with that. "Where did you stay when you got here? I mean, before the dorms? It's something I've been wondering." I didn't expect this, but I want to give her the answer. I take a long look at the ceiling and I nod in case she's watching me. I need a moment to steady my heart so I can speak. By the time I look back, she's shifted. Her head is resting on her hand, and she's watching me with a look I don't know if I've ever seen on her before. She's so still and so patient. "I found a motel." "Close by?" "Sort of. I think it was like 20 minutes away. I got on a bus from the airport and I rode the line until I saw a place out the window."
"What was it like?"
"Not nice."
"Why did you stay?"
"I guess it never occurred to me that I could leave." I think about walking into the room, the way it smelled, worse than stale, worse than unclean. I thought I might be able to exist there without touching anything, but then hours passed and it turned out I was wrong. It was a hotel where people live when they don't have anywhere else to go, I tell Mabel. Not a place where people stay on vacation. I pull the blanket over me, even though I'm not cold. It scared me, but I was already scared.
That's not what I pictured.
What did you think?
I thought maybe you got to move into the dorms early or something. Did you meet people?
At the motel? She nods. I wouldn't say that I met people. I had a lot of neighbors. Some of them became familiar.
I mean, did you hang out with them?
No.
I thought you must have met people.
I shake my head.
I thought they were helping you through everything.
No, I say. I was alone there.
In her face, something is shifting. A set of facts to replace all the guessing I made her do. I want to give her more.
There was a woman next door to me who howled, I say, at cars that went by, at people who passed. After I checked into my room, she howled for a few straight hours.
What was wrong with her?
I don't know. She sounded like a wolf. I kept wondering then, I'm still wondering now, if there was a time when she realized that something was going wrong. Inside her, I mean. When she could feel herself slipping away, something new creeping in. If she could have stopped it, or if it just happened. It made me think about Jane Eyre, remember?
The crazy woman. Mr. Rochester's first wife.
I felt like Jane when she sees her in the mirror. I was afraid. I'd listened to her at night, and sometimes I felt like I understood what she was trying to say. I was afraid I'd turn into her.
The fact of her was scary enough, but the fact of me, in an identical room, just as alone as she was, that was the worst part. There was only a wall between us, and it was so thin it was almost nothing. Jane, too, was once locked up in a room with a ghost. It was terrifying, the idea that we could fall asleep girls, minty-breathed and nightgowned, and wake to find ourselves wolves.
I can see why you don't want to read much right now.
I nod.
Before, they were just stories. But now they keep swarming back, and all of them feel more terrible.
She looks away, and I wonder if it's because I'm telling her things she can't relate to. Maybe she thinks I'm being dramatic. Maybe I am. But I know that there's a difference between how I used to understand things and how I do now. I used to cry over a story and then close the book, and it all would be over. Now? Everything resonates, sticks like a splinter, festers.
You were alone, she says, for all those days.
Does that change anything? She shrugs. You thought I met new people and didn't need you?
It was the only explanation I could think of.
I will tell her anything, as long as she keeps asking questions. It's the darkness and the warmth, the feeling of being in someone else's home, in neutral territory. Nothing mine and nothing hers. No clues about each other in the blankets or the firewood or the photographs on the mantle. It makes my life feel far away, even though I'm right here. What else do you want to know? I ask her.
I've been wondering about Birdie.
She shifts, and the springs pop and settle. My hands lie heavy in my lap. Her face is still watchful and willing. I can still breathe. Okay, I say. What about Birdie?
Does she know what happened? No one was there to check the mail and find her letters. By now they'd all be sent back, and I keep wondering if anyone told her that he died.
There was no Birdie, I say. Confusion flashes across her face.
I wait for the next question.
But the letters?
Ask me. I guess, she says, I guess it was too sweet of a story. All of those love letters to someone he never even met. I guess, she says again, he must have been really lonely to make something like that up. She won't meet my eyes. She doesn't want me to tell her anything more. At least not right now. I know what it's like to not want to understand, so we're quiet while her last sentence spins and spins in my head. And I think, I was lonely. I was. Touching knees under the table wasn't enough. Love seat lectures were not enough. Sugary things, cups of coffee, rides to school were not enough. An ache expands in my chest. He didn't need to be lonely. Mabel's brow furrows. I was there. He had me, but he wrote letters instead. She finally looks at me again. I was lonely, I say. And then I say it again, because I told myself lies for so long, and now my body is still, and my breath is steady, and I feel alive with the truth. Before I know what's happening, Mabel is pulling me close. I think I remember what this feels like. I try not to think of the last time we held each other, which was the last time I was held by anybody. Her arms are around me so tight that I can't even hug her back. So I rest my head on her shoulder, and I try to stay still so that she won't let go. Let's sleep, she whispers into my ear, and I nod, and we break apart and lie down again. I face away from her for a long time so that she won't see my sadness. To be held like that. To be let go. But then the ghost of me starts whispering again. She's reminding me of how cold I've been. How I've been freezing. She's saying that Mabel's warm and that she loves me. Maybe a love that's different than it used to be, but love all the same. The ghost of me is saying, 3,000 miles. That's how much she cares. She's telling me it's okay. So I turn over and find Mabel closer to me than I'd realized. I wait a minute there to see if she'll move away, but she doesn't. I wrap my arm around her waist, and she relaxes into me. My head nestles in the curve behind her neck. My knees pull up to fit the space behind hers. She might be asleep. I'll only stay here for a couple of minutes. Only until I thaw completely. Until it's enough to remind me what it feels like to be close to another person. Enough to last me for another span of months. I breathe her in. Tell myself I need to turn away. Soon. But not yet. Don't disappear again, she says. Okay? Her hair is soft against my face. Promise me. I promise. I start to turn, but she reaches back for my arm. She scoots her body closer into mine until the full lengths of us are touching. With each breath, I feel winter passing. I close my eyes, and I breathe her in. And I think about this home that belongs to neither of us. And I listen to the fire crackling. And I feel the warmth of the room and of her body. And we are okay. We are okay.
Chapter 14. 3 oranges. A bag of wheat bread. A note that reads, out Christmas shopping. Don't steal anything. I know where you live. Two mugs in front of a full electric coffee pot. Power's back, I say, and Mabel nods. She points to the note. Funny guy. Yeah, but kind of sweet. Completely. I don't think I've ever fallen asleep in a dark place and woken to see it in the light for the first time. Last night, I made out the objects, but the color was missing. Now I see the windows, that their frames are painted a forest green. If it weren't completely white outside, the shade of the paint would match the trees. The curtains are patterned with blue and yellow flowers. You think Tommy picked these out? I ask. I hope he did, Mabel says. But no, I don't think so. Do you think he killed that deer? She turns toward the mantle as though the deer could speak and tell her. No. Do you? No, I say. Mabel opens up the bag of bread and takes out four slices. I guess we can go back when we're ready, she says. I pour us each a cup of coffee. I give her the better mug. I take the seat with the better view, because I've always cared more about what I'm looking out at than she has. The kitchen table's legs are uneven. Every time we lean forward, it tilts. We drink our coffees black, because he has no cream, and we eat our toast dry, because we can't find butter or jam. And I look outside most of the time that we sit here, but sometimes I look at Mabel instead. The morning light on her face, the waves in her hair, the way she chews with her mouth the slightest bit open, the way she licks a crumb off her finger. What? She asks, catching me smiling. Nothing, I say, and she smiles back. I don't know if I still love her in the way that I used to, but I still find her just as beautiful. She peels an orange, separates it in perfect halves, and gives one of them to me. If I could wear it like a friendship bracelet, I would. Instead, I swallow it section by section and tell myself it means even more this way. To chew and to swallow in silence here with her. To taste the same thing in the same moment. I swear, Mabel says, I feel like I could eat all day. I bought so much food. Do you think it went bad last night? Doubtful. It's freezing. Before long, we're washing our breakfast dishes and leaving them on a dish towel to dry. We're gathering up blankets from last night and setting them on the coffee table, folding the bed back in until it's only a couch again. We're standing in the empty space where the bed was, looking out the window at the snow. You think we'll make it back? Mabel asks. I hope so. We find a pen and write on the back of Tommy's note, include lots of thank yous and exclamation points. Ready? I ask her. Ready, she says. But I don't think it's possible to prepare yourself for cold like this. It steals our breath. It chokes us. When we round that corner, we'll see the dorm. That's all I can get out. Each breath hurts. Tommy cleared the small road earlier this morning, but it's slick and icy. We have to concentrate on each step. I watch my feet for so long. When I look up again, the dorm is ahead of us in the distance, but to get there we have to step off the road Tommy cleared and into the perfect snow. And when we do, we find how much has fallen. Snow is halfway up our calves, and we aren't wearing the right pants for that. It seeps through. It hurts. Mabel's shoes are thin leather boots, made for city streets in California. They'll be drenched by the time we make it to the door, probably ruined. Maybe we should have waited for Tommy to return and drive us back, but we're out here now, so we keep going. I don't know that I've ever seen such a clear sky. Blue and piercing, sharp in a way I didn't know the sky could be. Mabel's lips are purple. Shivering doesn't begin to describe what my body's doing.
Now we're close, though. The building towers above us, and I feel for the cold keys with fingers so stiff they can hardly bend to grasp them. And somehow, I get the key into the lock, but we can't pull open the door. We scoop snow off the ground with our hands, kick it away with our boots, pull at the door until it pushes the rest away in an arc, like one wing of a snow angel. And then we let it shut behind us. "Shower," Mabel says in the elevator, and when we reach my floor, I run into my room and grab the towels, and we step into separate shower stalls and pull off our clothing, too desperate for warmth to let the moment be awkward. We stay under the water for so long. My legs and my hands are numb, and then they're burning, and then, after a long time, a familiar feeling returns to them. Mabel finishes first. I hear her water shut off. I give her some time to go back to my room. I'm not sorry to stay under the hot water for a little while longer. Mabel's right. The food is still cold. We're side by side in the rec room, peering into the refrigerator, heat pumping through the vents. "You bought all of this?" she asks. "Yes," I say, "but I don't need to. My name is still on everything." "I vote chili," she says. "There's cornbread to go with it, and butter and honey." "Oh my God, that sounds good." We open and shut all the drawers and cabinets until we found a pot for the chili, a grater for the cheese, a baking pan for the cornbread, and plates and silverware. As I'm pouring the chili into the pot, Mabel says, "I have some news. Good news. I've been waiting for the right moment." "Tell me." "Carlos is having a baby."
"What?"
"Griselda's 5 months pregnant." I shake my head in wonder. Her brother Carlos was away at college before the time Mabel and I became friends, so I've only met him a few times, but...
"You're going to be an aunt," I say.
"Tia Mabel," she says.
"Amazing. Right?"
"Yeah." They made us do this video conference call. My parents in the city, me at school, them in Uruguay.
"Is that where they're living now?"
"Yeah, until Griselda finishes her doctorate." I was annoyed. It took forever to get the call to work, and then when they finally showed up on my screen, all I saw was her little belly. I started bawling. My parents were both bawling. It was awesome. And it came at a perfect time, because they were all emotional about clearing Carlos's stuff out of his room. Not that they didn't want to. They were just like, "Our son is all grown up and he'll never be our little boy again." And then they were like, "Grandchild!" They'll be the best grandparents. They're already buying stuff for the baby. Everything is gender neutral because it's going to be a surprise. I think of Mabel and her little niece or nephew, about her traveling to Uruguay to meet this new life, and watching a person grow, from inside a round belly, to a baby, to a kid who can tell her things. I think of Anna and Javier, so excited, remembering who they were when Carlos was young. I almost gasp. I don't know if I've ever thought this way about the expansiveness of a life. I think about it as it is in the wider world, in nature and time, in centuries and galaxies. But to think of Anna and Javier being young and in love, having their first baby, and watching him grow up, get married, move across the world, knowing that they'll soon have another descendant to love, knowing that they'll grow older as time passes, they'll become old the way Gramps was, with gray hair and a tremble in his step, so much love still in their hearts. This astonishes me. I am capsized. Despite the sweetness of the news, loneliness, bottomless and black, rushes in. I want to know what Gramps felt when he learned my mom was pregnant. She was young, and the boy wasn't in the picture, but surely Gramps must have felt some gladness in spite of it. I wonder if, once the shock passed, he whooped and danced at the thought of me. She tells me more about Carlos and Griselda's plans, what the due date is, what names she likes.
I'm making lists, she says. I'll read them to you. I mean, I'm sure they'll come up with their own, but what if I find the perfect name?
I'm trying to stay here with her, in her happiness.
I'd love to hear them, I say.
Oh, no, she says, pointing. The chili got too hot. It's bubbling and spilling over. We turn it down to a simmer. The cornbread still has 20 minutes to go. I listen to her ideas about nurseries and what she'll do in lieu of a baby shower, since she won't be able to travel that far during the spring semester. I last as long as I can. I do. I just can't shake the loneliness. So when there's a break in the conversation, when it seems like the topic of her niece or nephew has passed, I sit at the table and she sits across from me. You said he was cute, I say. Gramps was. Her brow furrows. I apologized for that. No, I say. I'm sorry. Tell me again. She looks at me. Please. She shrugs. He was just always doing these adorable things, like polishing those candlesticks. Who does that? He would sit at the round table in the kitchen, humming along with the radio, shining the brass until it shone. And playing cards with his friends all day, like it was their job or something, saying it kept his mind sharp when really it was about drinking whiskey and having company, right? And winning money? I nodded. He won more often than the others. I think that's how he sent me here. A couple decades of winning at small stakes poker. She smiles. All of those sweets he made, how he loved when I spoke Spanish, and the songs he sang, and the lectures he gave us. I wish we had listened better. I feel like there was so much more we could have learned from him. She shoots me a quick glance and says, at least I could have learned so much more. I don't want to speak for you. No, I say. I've thought of that too. It was impossible to know what the subject of the lecture would be until he started it, and some of them felt so random at the time. But maybe they weren't. Once, he did a 3-day series on stain removal.
Like for laundry?
Yeah, but with lots of variations. It went beyond clothes. How to get a stain out of a carpet, when to use fizzy water, and when to use bleach, how to test to see if the colors would bleed.
Amazing.
Yeah, but I really learned it. I can get stains out of anything.
I'll keep that in mind, she says. Don't be surprised if you get packages of my laundry.
What have I started? We smile. The joke settles.
I miss his face, Mabel says.
Me too. The deep lines by his eyes and mouth, in the center of his forehead. His short, coarse eyelashes and ocean blue eyes. His nicotine-stained teeth and his wide grin. And how he loved jokes, she says, but always laughed the hardest at his own.
It's true. There are so many other things, too, that are harder to put into words. I could try if you want me to.
No, I say. It's enough. I stop my mind from taking me back to that last night and my discoveries. Instead, I play each thing that Mabel said over and picture them all, one by one, until they turn into other memories, too. How it sounded when he walked the hall in his plaid slippers. How clean and short he kept his fingernails. The low rattle of his throat clearing. A soft glow settles in, a whisper of what used to be. It fends off some of the loneliness. And then I think of something else Mabel said.
Why were they clearing out Carlos's room?
She cocks her head.
For you. I already told you they redid it.
But I thought you meant the guest room.
That room is tiny. And it's for guests.
Oh, I say. A mechanical ding blares. I guess I just assumed. The ding repeats. It's the oven timer. I'd almost forgotten where we were. I don't know what I'm trying to say anyway, so I check on our cornbread and find it risen and golden. Something is shifting inside me. A heavy cloud passing. A glimpse of brightness. My name painted on a door. After searching a row of drawers, I discover a worn oven mitt covered in illustrated gingerbread men. I show Mabel.
How seasonally appropriate, she says.
Right? It's so threadbare, the pan's heat seeps through, but I manage to drop the loaf on the stovetop before it hurts too much. The scent fills the room. We spoon chili into mismatched bowls from the cabinet and heap them with sour cream and pre-shredded cheese. We spoon out the honey for the cornbread, unwrap the butter. I want to hear about your life, I say. I know I should have told her this months ago. I should have told her yesterday and the day before that. Mabel tells me about Los Angeles, about all of the name-dropping that goes on around her, about how lost she felt in her first few weeks there, but how lately she's been feeling more at home. We look up the website for Anna's gallery, and Mabel tells me about her most recent art show. I scroll through butterfly images, each wing made of fragments of photographs, and then hand-dyed in rich pigments until the photographs are unrecognizable. I could tell you what they're about, she says, but I'm sure you can figure it out on your own. I ask her who she's heard from, and she tells me that Ben's liking Pitzer. She says he's been asking about me. He's been worried, too. They keep saying they'll get together one weekend, but that Southern California is huge. Going anywhere takes forever, and they're both settling into their own new routines anyway. It feels good to know he's there, though, not too far away if I needed a friend from home. She pauses. You remember that there are other people in New York, too, right? I shake my head. I hadn't even thought about it for so long. Courtney's at NYU. I laugh. That's never going to happen. Eleanor's at Sarah Lawrence. I never really got to know her. Yeah, me neither. But she's really funny. How far is Sarah Lawrence from here?
What are you trying to do?
I just don't want you to be alone.
And Courtney and Eleanor are somehow going to fix that?
Okay, she says. You're right. I'm acting desperate. I stand up to clear our dishes, but after I stack them, I just set them aside. I sit back down, swipe my hand across the table to sweep away the crumbs. I want to hear more, I say. We got off track. I already told you about my favorite classes. Tell me about Jacob, I say. She blinks, hard. We don't have to talk about him. It's okay, I say. He's a part of your life. I want to hear about him. I don't even know how serious it is, she says. But I know that she's lying. The way she talks to him at night. The way she says, I love you. I look at her and wait. I can show you a picture, she says. I nod. Out comes her phone. She swipes a few times and then decides on one. They're sitting next to each other at the beach, shoulders touching. He's wearing sunglasses and a baseball cap, so I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be seeing. I look at the image of her instead. Her wide smile, her hair in a braid over her shoulder, her bare arms, and the way she's leaning into him. You guys look happy together, I say. It comes out true and simple. It comes out without bitterness or regret. Thanks, Mabel whispers. She takes the phone back. She puts it in her pocket. A minute passes. Maybe a few of them. Mabel takes the plates I stacked to the sink. She washes them, both plates, both bowls, and the pot and the pan, and the silverware. At some point, I get up and find a dish towel. She scrubs the splattered chili off the stove, while I dry everything and put it away. Chapter 15. July and August. It was a summer of staying out late, a summer of wandering. It was no longer a given that I'd be home for dinner, as though Gramps and I were practicing for our near futures without each other. Some nights early on, he left food out for me. Once or twice I called to tell him I'd bring leftovers from something Javier made. Slowly, the dinners tapered off altogether. I feared he wasn't eating, but he wouldn't admit to it when I asked him. One day I went to the basement to do the laundry and found one of his socks was stuffed with bloody handkerchiefs. 7 of them. I laid them out one by one and used the tricks he taught me. I waited by the washer for its full cycle, hoping it would work. All 7 came out clean, but my throat stayed tight. My stomach ached. I folded them, one by one, in little squares. I carried them upstairs on the top of the pile. Gramps was in the dining room when I got there, pouring himself a glass of whiskey. He eyed the folded laundry. "How've you been feeling, Gramps?" He cleared his throat.
"So-so,"
he said. "Have you been to the doctor?" He snorted. My suggestion was ridiculous, and I remembered a time in junior high when I came home from health class and talked to him about the dangers of smoking.
"This conversation is very American,"
he'd said.
"We live in America." "That we do, sailor. That we do. But wherever in the world we live, something's gonna get us in the end. Something gets us every time."
I hadn't known then how to argue his point. I should have tried harder.
"You never touch this stuff,"
he said now, holding up the bottle of whiskey.
"Right?"
I shook my head.
"Besides that one time, I mean,"
he said. "That was the only time."
"Good,"
he said.
"Good."
He twisted the top back onto the bottle and picked up his glass.
"You have a couple minutes? I have some things to show you."
"Sure." He gestured toward the dining table where some papers were spread out. He said,
"Sit with me."
In front of me were documents from my soon-to-be college, thanking us for our payment in full for the first 2 semesters. There was an envelope with my social security card and my birth certificate. I didn't know he had them.
"And this," he said, "is the information for your new bank account. It looks like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. But it will run out. After you're gone, no more $4 coffee. This is food and bus fare money. Textbooks and simple clothing."
My heart pounded. My eyes burned. He was all I had.
"Here is your new ATM card. The code is 4073. Write that down somewhere."
"I can just use my normal card," I said, "from the account I share with you." I looked again at the dollar amount on the statement. It was more money than I had ever seen belong to us. "I don't need all this."
"You do,"
he said. Then he paused and cleared his throat.
"You will."
"But all I care about is having you." He leaned back in his chair, took off his glasses, cleaned them, put them back on.
"Sailor."
His eyes were yellow as daisies. He'd been coughing up blood. He looked like a skeleton, sitting there next to me. He shook his head and said,
"You've always been a smart girl."
It was a summer of trying not to think too deeply, a summer of pretending that the end wasn't coming, a summer when I got lost in time, when I rarely knew what day it was, rarely cared about the hour, a summer so bright and warm it made me believe the heat would linger, that there would always be more days, that blood on handkerchiefs was an exercise in stain removal, and not a sign of oblivion. It was a summer of denial. Of learning what Mabel's body could do for mine, what mine could do for hers. A summer spent in her white bed, her hair fanned over the pillow. A summer spent on my red rug, sunshine on our faces. A summer when love was everything, and we didn't talk about college or geography, and we rode buses and hopped in cars and walked city blocks in our sandals. Tourists descended onto our beach, sat in our usual places, so we borrowed Anna's car and crossed the Golden Gate to find a tiny piece of ocean to have for ourselves. We ate fish and chips in a dark pub that belonged in a different country, and we collected beach glass instead of shells, and we kissed in the redwoods. We kissed in the water. We kissed in movie theaters all over the city during matinees and late-night showings. We kissed in bookstores and record stores and dressing rooms. We kissed outside of the Lexington because we were too young to get in. We looked inside its doors at all the women there with short hair and long hair, lipstick and tattoos, tight dresses and tight jeans, button-ups and camisoles, and we pictured ourselves among them. We didn't talk about Mabel's departure, which was to come half a month before mine. We didn't talk about the blood on the handkerchiefs or the coughs that ricocheted from the back of my house. I didn't tell her about the paperwork and the new ATM card, and I barely thought about them, only when I found myself without Mabel, only in the darkest and most silent hours. And when I did, I pushed the thoughts away. But it turns out that even the fiercest denial can't stop time. And there we were, at her house, there in her foyer were the suitcases and duffel bags she'd packed when I wasn't looking. They'd be loading the car the next morning. Anna and Javier invited me to come on the round-trip drive to Los Angeles, but I couldn't bear the thought of returning without her, the only backseat passenger, and Mabel looked relieved when I said no. "I think I would have cried the whole way," she told me in her room that night. "I might cry the whole way anyway, but if I'm alone, you won't have to watch me do it." I tried to smile, but I failed. The trouble with denial is that when the truth comes, you aren't ready. We opened her laptop. We looked for directions from Los Angeles to Dutchess County. It was a 40-hour drive. We said 40 hours didn't seem like that much. We'd expected it to be longer. We could meet in Nebraska, and then it would only be 20 hours for each of us. No problem, we said. But we couldn't meet each other's eyes. It was the middle of the night when Mabel whispered, "We aren't going to meet in Nebraska, are we?" I shook my head. "We don't even have cars." "There are the breaks," she said. "We'll both come home for those. Everyone says 4 years, but really it's just a few months at a time, and then a few months home every summer." She nodded. She ran her hand along the side of my face. And the morning came too soon. So much brightness, so much clatter in the kitchen. I knew I wouldn't be able to stomach anything, so I put on my clothes and I left before breakfast. I listened to the same heartbroken song the entire bus ride home, because it was still a summer when sadness was beautiful. Chapter 16. Our time is running out, and I'm not ready. I'm feeling the dorm's emptiness again. It's settling in, that it's not going to transform for Christmas, that it's going to look exactly the same as it does now, only one person emptier. It won't be warmer inside or blink with lights or smell like pine. It won't fill with Gramps' songs. Where did our ornaments go? The little angel bell, the painted horse, the tiny tree, the letter M stitched with sequins. It's noon, and then it's 1. I keep looking at my phone because I don't want the time to sneak up on me. It's 2, and my body is heavy and sinking, and I can't shake the feeling that everything is ending all over again, only it's worse this time because I know what awaits me when it's over. It's 2:30. There's still so much I need to tell her. She hasn't asked me anything else about Gramps. She hasn't mentioned the name Birdie since last night. I know that feeling of not wanting to know. But at the same time, I think that she would listen if I started. I think we're playing a game without meaning to. We both want the other one of us to go first. It's 3 before I say anything, but then I have to start. I force myself to start. I need to tell you what happened after you left, I say. We are back in my room, sitting on the rug, looking through a stack of Hannah's magazines. I see pages of perfect houses and perfect outfits, but I can't concentrate on any of the words that accompany them. Mabel closes her magazine and sets it down. She looks at me. Chapter 17. August. The mornings after she left, I woke up early. I don't know why. I wanted to sleep the days away, but I couldn't. The fog was heavy over the rooftops and telephone wires and trees, and I would make myself tea and then go back to my room to read and wait until the sun broke through. Then I would go to Ocean Beach. I'd sit by myself in the spot where Mabel and I used to hang out and stare out at the water. I was trying to remember my mother. I didn't think of it that way for all those years I'd been doing it, but it was clear to me by then. The waves would come in, and I would try to remember the way she must have looked up on her surfboard, how she would have dragged it behind her as she came back to shore, how she would have waved to me with her other hand. Maybe I sat right here with her friends. Maybe the buried memories of those days are what led me back each time. It was mid-August, and Mabel had left just a few days before, and I was supposed to leave in a little over 2 weeks. That morning was quiet, only a couple of guys surfing in the distance. When they got out of the water, they stood around talking, and at one point I saw them look over at me. I could feel what they were saying. 2 of them were telling a third who I was. It felt so unfair that they could remember her and I couldn't. Maybe if I closed my eyes, just listened. I knew that smells triggered memories, so I breathed in deep. And then I heard a voice. It was one of the guys. The other 2 were gone. "Marin," he said, "right?"
"Yes."
I squinted up at him, wondered if my hair reminded him of hers. I thought he might tell me about something intangible, an aura I gave off or a gesture I made.
"What are you waiting around for?"
"Nothing," I said. But it wasn't true. I was waiting for a faraway nostalgia to take him over, the way it always did with all the others. I almost held out my hand, sure he'd drop shells in. Maybe the feeling of them in my palm would do it.
"I heard you looked a lot like your mom, but this is ridiculous."
He didn't sound dreamy at all, but I smiled anyway and said thanks.
"I've got a van in the lot and some time to spare," he said. My body tensed.
In spite of the lead in my stomach, in spite of the way I was sinking into the sand, darkness rushing in, I made my voice stronger. "Who are you even?" I asked.
"I'm Fred," he said.
"Never even heard of you." I turned to the ocean and watched the waves crash. The more focused I was on them, the louder they were, the closer they became. When a wave reached the toe of my shoe, I stood up. I was alone, just like I'd hoped. But it felt terrible. I needed something. Anna, I thought. But that was stupid. Anna was not mine. I needed a warm place, music, sweet-smelling rooms. Traffic parted for me. The darkening sky held its light until I unlocked my door and rushed upstairs.
"Gramps!" I called. "Emergency! I need cake!"
He wasn't in the living room or the dining room. The kitchen was empty. Nothing on the stove or in the oven.
"Gramps?"
I stood still and listened. Quiet. He must have been out, I thought. But I found myself at the door of his study. I saw him. Couldn't believe it, but there he was at his desk, cigarette smoldering in the crystal ashtray, pen in hand, staring blankly off. Gramps?
Not a good time.
His voice wasn't even his voice. Sorry, I said, backing away. I found my way to the love seat. I wanted a lecture about anything. The correct name for a coffee establishment, the duplicity of nuns, the difference between carnal desire and the love for someone's soul. I wanted to touch knees under the table. I wanted him to tell me about my mother. Night fell and he didn't come out. He didn't make dinner. I sat on the love seat perfectly still until my back got sore and my feet fell asleep and I had to stand to get the blood rushing again. I got ready for bed, and then I went to my room in the front of the house, where nobody ever went but me. Chapter 18
Marin, she says, please talk to me.
I guess I've gone silent. I didn't even realize it.
I miss him,
I whisper. It isn't what I expected to say. It just comes out. I don't even know if it's true. I do miss him. But then I don't. She scoots closer.
I know, she says. I know. But you're trying to tell me something. I want to hear it.
Her knee is so close to mine. She isn't afraid to touch me now that we've held each other all night. I love her, but there is no going back. No bonfires on the beach, no mouths pressed together, no hungry fumblings, no fingers through her hair. But maybe I can go further back, to a less complicated time when cute was an accurate description of my grandfather, and Mabel was simply my best friend. I want to tell her, but I can't do it yet. The words are stuck. Tell me something, I say.
What?
Anything. Tell me about heat. Tell me about the beach. Tell me about a girl who lives in a house with her grandfather, about a house that's full of easy love, about a house that isn't haunted, hands covered in cake flour and air that smells sweet. Tell me about the way the girl and her grandfather did each other's laundry and left it folded in the living room, not because there were secrets, but because that's just the way they were, simple and easy and true. But before she can say anything, the words come. None of it was real, I tell her. She scoots closer. Our thighs touch. She takes my hands in hers like we used to do on the beach, like I'm freezing and she can warm me.
None of what was real?
Him, I whisper.
I don't understand, she says.
He had a walk-in closet behind his room. It's where he really lived. It was filled with all this stuff.
What kind of stuff?
Letters, to start. They were all written by him. He signed her name, but he wrote all of them.
Marin, I don't...
Chapter 19 August Gramps' leaving woke me up. The door shutting, footsteps down the stairs. I peered out to the street and saw him turn the corner in the direction of the store, or Beau's house, or any number of the places he disappeared to during his walks through the neighborhood. I'd slept in. It was already 11 when I got into the shower. Once out, I boiled some eggs and left two in a bowl for him. I made tea for myself and then placed a second bag into a teacup for him to find when he returned. I read on the sofa for a while. Then I went out. I spent the rest of the day in Dolores Park with Ben and Lainey, throwing the ball for her, laughing with Ben, going over every shared memory from the last 7 years of our lives. We tied Lainey to a pole outside Ben's favorite taqueria and watched all the hipsters stop and pet her.
How will you live without this?
he said as we bit into our burritos. Is there even Mexican food in New York? Honestly, I have no idea.